You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 22nd, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
So, guys, our trip to England
is
just about complete. We do have one opportunity in our schedule that's not filled. We actually don't have any events in London proper. Open to the public. So we're trying to set that up. So actually, I'd like to reach out to anyone who listens to the show who lives in London, especially if you're a member of like a London Skeptics or Humanists or whatever, any kind of group in London that can help us organize an open to the public meeting where we will put on a show. We'll, you know, be available to meet and greet, and we will sign books.
Oh, cool. So we want to do a show too.
Yeah, whether it's, you know, Q&A or, you know, we'll do some kind of presentation.
Fun.
Yeah, we'll do something fun.
Maybe we can read the book with British accents.
Yes, I know they would love that.
They would love that, right?
Oh, yeah, that, yeah.
Don't step on my recording of the first chapter of the book in a British accent.
Oh, yeah. Can we hear a little taste of that, Jay?
That's right, love. Science and all.
It's like My Fair Lady.
But that's
the ride is fine, falls finally on the plane.
That's only one of many different kinds of accents I will be presenting in this demonstration.
You'll also have a chimney sweep.
That's right.
Yeah, Jay's a veritable encyclopedia of fake British accents.
Speaking of bad accents, Steve.
Yeah.
I want to remind our listeners that we do have a Patreon. So we have a big goal coming up. I know that most of you know about this, but the next goal at 3,000 patrons, the SGU is going to hire its first full-time employee, and it's going to be me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And Steve is so super excited about this.
I have the list of stuff that you're going to do, Jay. It gets bigger every day.
Including sweeping the chimneys as well.
Yeah, it's very important. We have 2,470 patrons, so we're really close.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, just over 500 patrons. So the reason why we need to do this is that we want to increase the Skeptic's Guide's reach. We want to also increase what we can do. Because, you know, before we all die, now Kara's not going to die for a long time, but before the rest of us die in the next few years, we would like to leave a mark on this planet that would make our wives proud.
But my favorite, though, Jay, is, you know, as much as I'm looking forward to being able to boss you around full time, is that 4,000 patrons, we are going to put on a 12-hour SGU live show. At 5,500 patrons, we're going to put on a 24-hour SGU live show. How about
that? That's your favorite? Oh.
Yeah.
You're like actually looking forward to that?
Right.
Kara, I don't know why. Like, Steve loves, he absolutely loves. Oh my God, I just realized something. Oh my God, what a nightmare. If we get there, I'm going to be a full time employee, which means I'm going to do most of the work.
Yes.
Yeah.
See how strategically arranged those goals were?
I just think it's funny that Steve loves a 24 hour show when we're traveling, when we're traveling, Steve can't stay awake past like 10 p.m.
Yeah, I need my people sleep.
He didn't say we have to stay awake for 24 hours.
Oh, I see. This is going to be a live feed of us all snoring.
Not all of us. We'll take shifts.
We talked about it, though.
That's what you guys did last time. You just walk away, take a two-hour nap, come back refreshed.
But Bob and
Evan and I stuck it out. We did not sleeps, except for the micro naps at the table at the desk itself.
The two-hour nap was actually not refreshing. That was just long enough to get me into that stage four sleep where I'm comatose.
Yeah.
And then it's worse trying to dig yourself out of that hole.
Yeah, that's tough.
I don't know.
You're better off just staying awake.
To go.
So the side goal would be that if we end up doing a 12 or 24 hour live show that
and 24 hour, not
or. Yeah. Well, we're going to try for one of those two shows to do it at the Star Trek Museum.
Yes.
Which is in upstate New York in the United States. Now, if we do that, then I promise you, if I can pull that off and I can
24 hours won't be enough, Jay.
But I swear to you that there will be some extraordinarily fun and outrageous content on that set.
Oh, my gosh.
We're going to call it the Education of Kara Santa Maria.
Oh, my God.
Jay, we're going to be crawling around the set of the Enterprise on the 21st hour of 24 hours out of our
Jay, the whole thing. Let's say we have 24 hours. We have to live on that set for 24 hours. The whole thing will be framed as a mission. Absolutely. Are in deep space on a mission the whole time.
You know it. You know it. I'm going to pull out all the stops. I'm going to look at it like it's the last cool thing I'm going to do in my life.
It probably will be.
Yeah, right?
I'm going to repeat the star date every hour. Captain's log, yeah. Star date.
But most importantly.
Same as last hour.
Most importantly, as our listeners.
Evan, you're the engineer, not the captain.
I can't take it, Captain.
I'm gonna dress like Kirk and have somebody walk around specifically for me to shine that white light just across my eye.
Yeah,
automatic lighting just over the eyes.
Yeah, and also Bob, people grip. Should walk up to you and just have you randomly sign things.
Yes,
the clipboard.
Make one of those clipboards just for that.
I think it was an Etch a Sketch that they handed.
An Etch a Sketch?
No, actually, there's a really good prop on eBay.
Jay, that's a great idea.
Yeah, of course. Bob, you know,
we're just getting started.
About this. I've been thinking about this a lot because it's a lot of fun. Like, you know, when I'm falling asleep and I just want to think about something and kind of relax, I think about like what would we do on that set. So, I mean, I'm going to have a million ideas. So, but. You know, all sci-fi kidding aside and everything, you know, our dreams of all this fun stuff that we want to do, the real reason behind all of this is that we really do want to change the world. And if you believe in the show, if you believe in the work that we do, you know, as a listener, you're the people that can help us make these changes. You know, we get tons of emails from listeners saying that we've had an amazing impact on them, and we want to spread that impact to even more people. So please consider becoming a patron. You can go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and you can join the SGU family. You can get on our Discord server. We have a thriving community on Discord. You know, I'm on there every day. Bob's girlfriend Liz is on there every day. Everyone else is promising to get on even more.
Mm-hmm. I'm on there occasionally. You know, I'm usually lurking there when I'm doing the show on Saturday morning.
Oh, neat.
But there aren't that many people on there. But if you pop on and I'm doing my post-production, I'll interact with you on Discord.
You know, they're all going to like, everybody
they're gonna
come on
you.
Saturday mornings now.
Here comes the bombardment.
Well, hey,
yeah.
Do it.
2,400 hellos.
And Jay, you bring up that we change lives. And again, with all appropriate humility, we are doing this, not just for shits and giggles, because we want to make the world a little bit more rational if we can. And we do love it when we get these stories from our listeners about the impact that we had on them. And just recently on the Discord server, somebody was saying, hey, I wouldn't have gone for my PhD in science if it weren't for the SGU.
Oh, wow.
We'd love to hear stuff like that. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. But I got to say, Jay, you might want to change the world, but my end goal is to basically spend a day on the Enterprise. So yeah. I'm done. When that happens, I walk away.
Oh, wow. That's probably why I'm going to get the job, Bob. So please go to Patreon, become a SGU member, and help us do what we got to do to make the world a better place.
And buy our book. Go to theskepticsguy.org/book. And it'll take you to the Skeptics Guide to the Universe book, which is due out October 2nd. I just got my schedule to be in the studio to do the audiobook. Oh, it's going to be brutal. Brutal.
Yeah.
Because I'm basically working a full-time job. And then, in my spare time, I got to record 42 hours in the studio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot.
But I'll do it. We get a lot of questions about, is there going to be an audiobook? Is there going to be an audiobook?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's going to be an audiobook. It's worth it. It's worth it. But yeah, I'm not looking forward to those 2 weeks.
Yeah, but it'd be, you're paying it forward, man.
Yeah, I guess so. All right, let's get on with the show. Kara, you're going to start us off with what's the word?
This week we're going to talk about transfection.
Nice.
Does anybody already know what transfection is, what it relates to? Everybody feel pretty comfortable with that that word.
A confection is a sugary treat. So
a confection is a sugary treat.
Yeah. So transfection is something that changes from a sugary treat to something else.
And Bob, I hear you in the background.
Yeah. So infecting a cell with something.
Actually, that's like kind of the best definition. I've been reading about this a lot, and the definition really varies in broadness and specificity. Different researchers feel wildly different about how specific we should be when we talk about transfection. But for the most part, most definitions you'll find online have to do with infecting cells with nucleic acids, specifically free nucleic acids, plasmids, these like round nucleic acids that you find in bacteria. But what you'll find is that a lot of them will talk about viruses, making sure that the viral nucleic acid is part of the conversation. Some of them will say that we're specifically talking about making sure something makes its way into the genetic material of the cell. Sometimes they specifically mention using plasmids. Sometimes they don't. And then other definitions are super broad. They're basically like, deliberately putting something into a cell is transfection. The problem is that there are other terms that are kind of similar. And so we have to make sure that when we talk about transfection, that we're being very, maybe not specific, but that we're making sure that the word is easy to understand. Like we know what we're talking about and we don't confuse it for another process. So we can talk about transduction, which is gene transfer into eukaryotic cells and usually specifically uses viruses. We can talk about transformation, which appears to kind of be involved in the root of transfection, and that is non-viral transfer between bacteria of DNA and also other eukaryotic cells that aren't animals. So you guys have heard of horizontal transfer between different bacteria?
Sure. That's a key ability.
Yeah. And so that may occur via transformation. But some people actually talk about, and I found a good blog post online in from a virologist, right? Because this is sort of a microbiology term, but obviously if you want to be a splitter, you know, we often talk about lumpers and splitters in taxonomy, but also if you want to be a splitter when it comes to different types of science, you know, science is becoming so specific now that there are whole fields and whole labs that are subspecialties of subspecialties. So, you know, we talk about this as a microbiological term, but virologists specifically might use this slightly differently than people who only focus on bacteria. And so I found an interesting blog post from a virologist named Vincent Rossaniello, who was saying that transfection should only ever mean the introduction of viral DNA into cells. But then he goes on to talk about learning about the roots of the word. And at the end, finally says, it seems to me that without knowing it, those who used transfection in the wrong way were actually correct in their usage. I no longer need to fret about how transfection is used. So even he says he always thought it was a very specific thing that we had to talk about, DNA-mediated transformation, which is putting foreign DNA into cells from a virus, and that specifically is transfection. But even he is now saying, no, this can be much broader. We can really be talking about putting in proteins. We can be talking about putting in RNAs. We can talk about doing it through a plasmid, but we can also talk about like optical transfection, sonoporation, electroporation. There's a lot of smart, very cutting edge ways that we can get stuff into cells now. And the idea here is gene transfer, really. Like this is fundamental to much cell biology and much microbiology. This is how we do a lot of stuff. Like what kinds of things can we do with transfection? I mean, we've been doing this for decades now at this point. We are, you know, bringing in cargo in an effort to produce new drugs. We're bringing in cargo in an effort to change a cell in such a way that we can now study some sort of new behavior of the cell. And we're also bringing in new proteins, new DNA, new RNA to actually produce new versions of organisms. So there's a lot that you can do with transfection. It's not a very new technology, but it is kind of a specific term. And of course, we use it a lot when we're talking about GMOs, right? Isn't that, I think that might have been the context in the show when we brought it up, because we talk often about how GMOs, you know, we've been making genetically modified organisms for thousands of years because even breeding is a genetically modified organism. But of course, most people, when they're talking about GMOs, are talking about using transgenes. They're talking about going in the laboratory and infecting the DNA with something specific, whether it be from the same species or another. So when we look at the roots, transfection is pretty easy to break down. It's a portmanteau. That's an old word of what's the word?
I like that word.
Yeah, of either transfer, or some people would argue that it was transduction was actually the first root, and infection, right? So what we're doing is we're transferring via infection in an effort to get some sort of outcome with the target cell. And lots of stuff can come from it. There's a lot you can read about transfection, and there's a lot of very similar related terms. But ultimately, the core of what we're really talking about here is gene transfer.
Yeah, that's a good word to know, given that genetic manipulation is just is one of those technologies that is increasing and is going to be increasingly having an effect on our lives. So you'll be reading news items, which may be dropping the word transfect, or maybe not, but depending on how well-written they are, I guess. That's a good one to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it because it just sounds like an interesting word, like you could apply it to some like technobabble or sci-fi, like the confabulator transfected the matrix spanner, you know? It sounds good.
And eventually, we may get to a place where this is a way that we take drugs, too. You know, we often think about transfection as using a needle in a laboratory, like injecting a cell with a plasmid. But like I said, there's new technology that allows transfection via opening up pores in the membrane of the nucleus through electrical means or through pressure means. And eventually, maybe there will be pharmacological mediated transfection. And this is something that people might be doing themselves. And so it's definitely something that we should be fully aware of.
Absolutely. All right, Jay.
Steve.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How you doing, man?
So how is that room temperature superconductivity coming?
Really? Yeah, it's a little interesting story here. You know, we don't know what the truth is yet. The truth will come out. But there's been a little drama in the search for a superconductive material. So to give you a good summary, a superconductor simply means that a material can conduct electricity at zero electrical resistance and minimal energy loss, but a room temperature superconductor can do all of those things in the temperature ranges that humans normally live in, which would be amazing. This means that it wouldn't have to be cooled to make it possible to send electricity, say, over long distances. It would also open a door to other really cool technological advancements, right? So here are some of the cool ones that I was able to find. They were saying fast digital circuits. And when they say fast, they mean really, really fast digital circuits. Magnetic fusion containment fields. We're working on fusion reactors right now, and they're saying that if we were able to get room temperature superconductors, that the containment fields would work a lot better. And of course, the cost would go down to run the containment field, which overall means
hugely.
Yeah, hugely. And it would mean that the overall benefit to having a fusion reactor would go up. Maglev trains, these are magnetically levitated trains, particle accelerators, things like power grids that would maintain their energy and just not, in a horrible level, shockingly horrible level, lose the energy that are being sent through the wires. So scientists think that finding an inexpensive superconductive material would change the world, would change, what we're capable of doing. There's a lot of things that we would do and will do when and if we achieve this technology that we can't even think of yet. It's absolutely possible, and in fact, many scientists have been working to find materials that can do this for a long time. So we're not looking for something that is unlikely. We're looking for something that a lot of people agree we're going to find the appropriate, whatever it is. You know, you could think of it as, a mixture of different types of materials to get there. Or, we might build a nanostructure that can do it. I personally think, it's not in the far future. I think that we're going to get there hopefully within our lifetime. So in late July, Kara, a study was posted at the Archive, that's spelled ARXIV, by Dev Kumar Thapa and Ashu Pandey. They are scientists from the Indian Institute of Science, and in this study they report that a combination of gold and silver nanoparticles can achieve room temperature superconductivity. Of course, when the information
came out,
exactly, right? There was a mix of excitement and, of course, legitimate skepticism because, physicists have been fooled before. I've read false reports on superconductivity. Physicists know this is a really big one. This isn't like, minor claim, like, okay, whatever. Like, if people say they got there, you better be able to prove it. And, oh boy, if you're correct, the world's going to change. So, also, a lot of physicists wanted to delve into the details and actually wanted to also test their findings. There have been many claims that superconductivity was achieved at room temperature, but a lot of those were all of them were lies. An MIT physicist named Brian Skinner reported that he found something in the data that was used for the study that seemed to be an error. What he found was that there were two different sets of data. There were multiple sets of data that expressed how a superconductor repels different magnetic fields at various temperatures. And what he found was that these two discrete different sets of data had the same exact pattern of noise in the data set. So what we would expect to find is a completely random set of noise that should not fit into any kind of repeatable pattern. When I say noise, it's almost like audio white noise, that there's no pattern to it.
If it's repeatable, it doesn't sound like it would be noise to begin
exactly. with. Exactly. That's the exact point. So he was able to see this. I think he saw it actually visually. And then he realized, you know, wow, these two things look alike. And then he matched them up and they were exactly alike. And he
like
said,
like a clone?
Maybe they don't see. I'm sure that he, you know, initially was like, what is this, a copy and paste or whatever? But yeah. Skinner was hesitant to report his findings because, you know, he didn't want to come out, you know, like he's accusing them.
Accusatory, yeah.
You know, he's not against the two scientists who conducted the study. And he thought over it for a week and he asked several of his colleagues if they think that his findings were an honest mistake done by the researchers. And his colleagues agreed that there was no obvious explanation for the repeat pattern in these, you know, in these noise segments of data that represented noise. So Skinner ended up simply asking for an explanation about his findings. And it was very underwhelming. And he posted it on the archive. Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty common. So the archive is open access. So it's a place where people usually, especially in physics and engineering and like computer science, they'll publish there first. So that they can get, well, you know, because journal, like peer review can sometimes take years and it's great. I mean, we love the process, but it's too slow.
Yeah, it is very
slow. And so a lot of times people will bring stuff. Yeah. And so people will bring stuff to the archive first so that, you know, other people have access to the data and they can start working with it.
Start kicking it around. Yeah.
Yeah. But then, of course, things like this are found.
So in the end, Skinner felt obligated to go public for the sake of honesty, you know, mentioning separately that, you know, this is what scientists are supposed to do. And he felt obligated to do it. So he didn't accuse them of and I made up a word for you, Kara.
Mm-hmm.
He did not accuse them of fraudulating the data.
I like fraudulating.
It's a good word.
It is a good word.
They were fraudulating
the data. Otherwise, you have to say producing fraudulent data or committing fraud in their data production.
Yeah, fraudulating.
Fraudulating data.
Yeah, but you can't put that on your list, though.
I just added it.
You can't because that's for accidental. That's for accidental.
No, it was accidental. I said it.
I'm going to put an asterisk for Bob and put not an accidental.
It was the way we've been going.
Bob, when I was doing my research and I'm typing it out, I wrote the word fraudulating. And then when I was rereading and you know, paring down what I wrote, I made a note here. Please, you know, make sure Kara notices that I made up a word here.
All right. In that case, that passes muster.
Okay, good. We're all in agreement.
So he wanted to give the researchers the opportunity to respectfully respond, which of course, you know, like there's no reason to come out swinging. Like tell them, hey, look, what is this? Explain it. So other physicists confirmed that they agreed with Skinner's approach, which is great. You know, his community seemed to be backing him up on the way that he handled it. David Mueller, who was a physicist at Cornell University, he said that once he saw what Skinner observed, he thought it was game over for the claims of finding a superconductor, which, you know, is very deflating. The two scientists who wrote the paper have not responded to Skinner's question yet because they're waiting for outside validation of their results. And now the drama kind of begins because all of this seems above boards. Study was put out. Other scientists looked at the data. Somebody found something that they're curious about that didn't seem to line up, responds back to the people who put the paper up. And those people are saying, hey, let's just wait until we find out, you know, how this tests out in a peer review. Another researcher, Pratap Ray Chaudhuri, a physicist at Tata Institute of Fundamental Research in India, he set out to find the most plausible explanation for these data sets that were found. So he legitimately said, look, guys, you know, the noise could definitely be these signals that arise out of the natural rotations of particles that exist in the magnetic field. And, you know, it might look random, but maybe it isn't. Maybe it's just masquerading as noise. So he's throwing that out there like it could be something like that. But then what he goes on to say is, and then the original researchers should listen to feedback like this and discuss it, and they should send their samples along so other people can test it, right? So literally he's saying, hey, guys, me and probably other physicists are coming up with some rational explanations of why this data set could be like it is. What you really need to do is you need to take your gold and silver mixture concoction samples to other labs so people like me and other laboratories can test it. Because what they're doing is they're just doing more internal peer review testing, which is not really peer review testing because people are biased. You need to put it out to other people who aren't part of those labs, who aren't under the same funding and all of that to make it more legit. And they haven't done it. And Thapa said this kind of silence from the authors is not healthy. Is not a healthy practice. It's against the spirit of science, and I happen to agree. He goes on to say, getting this validated by your friends, by your next door colleagues, and so on, is not independent validation. These are all basics of the scientific method or our process, guys. You know, you don't do it that way. Please, guys, scientists out there, figure out what's going on here because we need superconductive toasters like STAT.
Do we really need those?
Toast your bread at near the speed of light.
Well, actually, that wouldn't work, but all right. I see what you're doing.
Electricity coming from the wall to my toaster, Bob, must be at lossless energy levels, okay?
All right. Okay, I see.
Yeah, Bob.
Yeah, but not in the toaster. You need the resistance to generate the heat.
That's right.
But anyway.
Exactly.
Toaster is actually like the farthest thing from superconductivity if you think about it.
Right. Could you imagine that would be great? I made a superconducting toaster. It doesn't work. all right. But the other thing here that I find fascinating is the whole notion of using statistical analysis of data to detect fraud. Because it's hard.
I like that.
It is really hard. In fact, it might be impossible to fake data in such a way that it's genuinely random, right?
Well, that is how they usually find fraud is because they see the same changes over and over.
Right. Because of some kind. Yeah. That's one way to detect. There's a pattern.
Mm-hmm. Just use quantum physics.
Generate a random number sequence in your head. It's not going to be random.
But there are tables in existence. So you just have to find a random table. You'd have to use a random table to fake your data. The problem is there's always parameters in data. So you can't fake it too much because it'll seem crazy. You have to fake it within parameters.
Yeah. There are complex patterns in real data. And to some extent, they follow statistical rules. And it would take a lot of work to generate fake data. You just can't make up numbers. You know what I mean? I do think that journal editors should be routinely screening data, just like you can routinely screen for plagiarism now using algorithms, right? Mm-hmm. So there should be a fraud algorithms run on any data before it gets published. That's just part of the editorial process.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine, Steve, that they could use algorithms to do certain types of data sets very easily, and then I'm sure there's other kinds that would be really hard. You know, the data sets have to lend themselves to be scannable in a certain fashion in order for them to be able to really use an algorithm to do it.
Well, yeah, you have to provide the data in a digital format so that it can be independently evaluated by the journal editor. That's pretty standard, actually. But it depends on the kind of research you're doing. Some research, providing all the raw data could be a huge pain in the ass. But whatever, we have to balance, you know, not overly burdening researchers, but at the same time having the transparency necessary to do real peer review and to screen for either just error or real fraud up front. You know, just we got to make it really hard to get past those filters with fraudulent data. That's what I think is like almost more important about this than the fact that this one study may have some issues, either new science or some, you know, questionable data, but it's just a bigger issue of, yeah, we really should be using algorithms to screen not only for plagiarism, but for fraud.
Yeah, that's a great point, Steve. I mean, let's use this as a, okay, formally, let's make this part of the methodology to help push things along.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus.
You ever get into an argument online, guys?
Oh,
I try to avoid them, but it happens.
At all costs. It happens all the time.
You know, the tale of being a critical thinker is that when we read comments online, It always seems like the people that are screaming the loudest online are the least informed.
They definitely don't seem to have learned much about formal logic, that's for sure.
But if you want to learn more about formal logic, there's a great course on the Great Courses Plus by Professor Stephen Gimbel from Gettysburg College on an introduction to formal logic. This is a really great course because it goes over all of the fundamentals of the philosophy of logic itself. We actually talk more about informal logic on the show and about skepticism. So this is a really good founding of formal logic. And if you don't know the difference between those two, listen to this course. It goes over things like inductive reasoning, truth functional logic, truth tables, modal logic, relational logic, first order predicate logic. And it's a great introductory course so you could wrap your head around what we mean when we talk about formal logic.
Now, Steve, isn't it true that after you watch that course, you can communicate in just beeps? So guys, with the Great Courses Plus, you can get unlimited access to this course and, you know, what, 10,000 other courses. You can stream their entire library to any piece of hardware that you have, and you can also learn from leading professors.
And you should start your free trial now. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics. Enjoy all of their fantastic lectures. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics for your free trial today.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Let's move on. There is another study looking at conspiracy thinking, which is something that I'm very interested in. I think we all are. This is something, we have a whole chapter dedicated to it in our book. And this is also part of the reason why we thought we needed to write the book, because the science of critical thinking is changing. There are new studies being published which help us understand better things like conspiracy thinking. We don't just want to assume we understand it, right? It's actually being studied. So what this study looked at was the role of teleology in conspiracy thinking. It's one of those things that sounds really wonky, because it is. But it's cool. But so teleology, you guys know what teleology is, right? That is
causes, yeah, right?
Yeah, teleology is when you say that the ultimate effect that something has is also the cause of why it happened. And
circular.
It's not just circular. It implies that there is some kind of force in the universe, some intelligence, some fate, something that makes things happen for a purpose. There's a purpose to the universe.
Uh-oh, design. Bad, bad.
Yeah, exactly. So creationism is the ultimate expression of teleology.
Is a teleological claim a logical fallacy?
Yes, because
it
you
is.
Can't,
yeah,
you can't reverse the cause and effect that way. It's like saying, and we all naively do this, it's like, oh, bees exist to pollinate flowers. No, they pollinate flowers, but that's not why they exist. You know, so even in evolution, it's easy to fall into the trap of making teleological statements. Mm-hmm. You know, this exists for this purpose that it has. No, they just using it for that purpose, but it evolved for its own reasons or just because of differential survival of random characteristics. You know, this is something that has been noted before, the idea that conspiracy theorists tend to see purpose in the universe, in the world. Right. Because they think that, oh, these random events happened for a reason, you know, so there's a lot of overlap in the thinking style. So the researchers wanted to specifically study the role of that kind of thinking in conspiracy thinking. Right. Whereas I would say the scientific model, the scientific philosophy is shit happens. Right. Things happen because they're mindlessly following the laws of physics, and the outcome, you know, those laws are blind to the outcome, and whatever outcome happens wasn't meant to happen. It just did happen for random reasons, right? Well, they wanted to know, you know, what the correlation is between teleological thinking and conspiracy thinking. Mm-hmm. So first they did a pilot study on a convenience sample of college students, of course.
Yep.
But then they did follow it up with a larger study in the general population. So that's fine. So the college students are a fine, again, convenient sample to start with. And what they found, actually, again, the headlines are always a little misleading because they tend to focus on the new bit. But the study actually found only a modest correlation between teleological thinking and conspiracy thinking. They looked at both agency and teleology in conspiracy thinking. Now, agency is something we have talked about before and I have written about before. The agency is the notion that, like, if you see the brushes waving, we tend to assume that there's a living, thinking agent doing it, right? It's a tiger rustling the bushes, not, it's the wind blowing. Mm. When things move in a certain way, there's wiring in our brain that is agency detection. We have agency detection built into our brains, and it's built into our visual system. It's sort of how we categorize the world. There are agents and then there are non-agents. And so we tend to have what's called hyperactive agency detection. We assume an agent until proven otherwise, if something acts in an agent type of way. And Jay, do you know what that is? What is the way something moves that makes our brain assume it's an agent?
I think a big thing would be that something like the head is looking around. Something is like observing the area around it.
Even more basic, if it has intentionality.
No, you would think that, but our brain follows a much – so what algorithm does our brain follow in visually in order to say that thing is moving like an agent and that thing is not moving like an agent?
If it's tracking something, apparently tracking something maybe, or
– I don't even think it's that high level.
It's very simple. Mm-hmm. If it's moving in an inertial frame, it's not an agent.
Oh, wow.
That's it. So meaning if it's moving in such a way that its movement can be entirely explained by gravity, right? That's an inertial frame.
Which is why wind and waves and things like that trick us.
So if something is moving not in an inertial frame in a way that cannot be explained entirely by gravity, we assume it's an agent. And then we until proven otherwise, right?
That's protective, right?
Sure. It's better to be safe than sorry.
Mm-hmm. Well, we evolved from those people who did that, right? Mm-hmm. Who had hyperactive agency detection. And there's clearly a correlation between hyperactive agency detection and conspiracy thinking. Because conspiracy thinking basically is hyperactive agency detection, right? It's these events are not random. They're connected by a pattern. So it's pattern seeking. I see the pattern and there's an agent behind that pattern. And now the authors are saying, and a new element, and there's a purpose to that pattern. And that's the teleology bit to it. But the teleology wasn't as strong as the agency and the pattern recognition. But it still was a factor. Does that make sense? So, sure.
Yeah, it seems like that people are uncomfortable with things they don't know. So therefore, they'll apply something to it to be more comfortable with it in a way.
That's a different aspect of it. And that is the emotional, psychological aspect of it. So the authors did a good job of summarizing the conspiracy research. And there's a lot of variables. So here are some of the things that correlate with conspiratorial thinking, right? Hyperactive agency detection, hyperactive pattern recognition, now a tendency to a teleological form of thinking, but also lack of acceptance of science, lack of analytical thinking, lack of trust in authorities, and a couple of the emotional ones, feeling that you lack control over your life, wanting to feel special. Correlate all of those things correlate with acceptance of conspiracy theories. So people who are generally frustrated by their lack of success in life are more likely to endorse conspiracies because it makes them feel special. So that was a study from about a year ago that showed that specifically. So anyway, it is that I think again I hated the reporting of this. The reporting of this was scientists discover the cause or the reason why people believe in conspiracies. No, actually, they found one additional and minor cause.
Yeah,
that not even cause, just correlation with conspiracy thinking, and we don't even know what the lines of cause and effect are because they could just be correlating with something else. I love the fact that there are researchers studying conspiracy thinking as a phenomenon so that we can understand it better because I think it's very important. It is it's behind rampant. So many of the things that we talk about. I think it's really good. And it's also fascinating because our field of skepticism, right, is moving forward, right? We're understanding these things better, which I love.
It's not – history is not always so clean. So when we talk about, for example, like why there are higher rates of conspiratorial thinking about medical intervention in certain African-American populations, then we talk about Tuskegee. And we're like, well, because there was actually evidence for certain things happening.
Right.
And so
right.
It gets really complicated for a lot of people, especially if they have, I don't know, alien abduction experiences that are very quote-unquote real to them. You know what I mean?
Well, that's I think now you're getting into fantasy proneness.
Well, yeah, that too. But definitely. So whether we're talking about a big conspiracy like there are UFOs that the government is hiding or not, when people have anecdotes that feed into the conspiracy that they saw with their own eyes, quote unquote, or they felt with their own bodies, that can really reinforce it too. So there's just a lot. Like, there's no way there's going to be a cause of conspiracy.
You're right. I know.
See, thinking. It's ridiculous. Crazy.
That's the narrative that we scientists knew nothing, and then they found this one thing which explains everything. Now we understand mm-hmm. it. Yeah, come
You're
on.
So right. That's every like popular science.
Yeah,
article.
I hate it. So Evan.
Yep.
Actually, did you guys hear? This is interesting. That in New Haven, right where I work on the mm-hmm. green, there was like 100 overdoses.
Yes. K2.
One day.
What was that about?
K2.
Synthetic marijuana.
Yeah, it was synthetic mm-hmm. marijuana, K2, well, that somebody
synthetic marijuana
was. It was basically like an herbal, you know, marijuana substitute. It's not marijuana. It's just a, you know, an herbal drug that people smoke that you
oh
could
God,
cut.
Yeah.
You know,
let's smoke this random herb.
And the person who was selling it had cut it with apparently like some powerful narcotic, and his oh people boy. Were dropping like flies on the New Haven Green.
More than 100 people.
More than 100 people. Yeah.
Dead?
No.
Like considered, freaking yeah. out. Like some of them, they were like running down the street, like losing it, and they would have to tackle them. And others would just drop on the ground. Were they convulsing, or were they just like?
No,
they just
they
like
were,
tripping balls.
They were just going unconscious. So it was yeah. a fun time in the emergency room.
Oh, jeez.
But you know, how'd they end up. Are they okay now?
Yeah, I don't think anyone has any permanent damage from it, but they did arrest.
But that must
they
be
did
so
arrest
hard,
somebody over it.
Because they don't know what it is right away, so how
right.
do you treat it?
Right, exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, but you got to be careful about consuming random herbs that someone's giving you.
Yeah,
right?
Huh?
Definitely. Yeah, you sure do. Because, well, just yesterday, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported that there have recently been 4 confirmed deaths related to the herbal supplement Kratom. Kratom. And again, this all happened just within the Philadelphia area recently. And yeah, that's right, herbal supplement. It's actually available in several different forms. It's sold in smoke shops, it's sold as an herbal tea, and it's also sold as a chewing product. But it is branded and marketed and sold as a supplement as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yikes. Mm. So what exactly is kratom? Kratom is the common name for Mitragyna speciosa. That's the plant from which it comes from. And the plant grows naturally in Southeast Asia and parts of Africa. And like all other so-called herbs, kratom is a drug. Whenever you hear the word herb, think drug. So what kind of drug is kratom? Well, it's the kind of drug that, according to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, affects the same opioid brain receptors as morphine and appears to have properties that expose users to the risks of addiction, abuse, and dependence. And what do the kratom supplement companies claim? In other words, what can kratom do for their consumers? Well, you'll see things like weight loss, pain relief, mood enhancement, and energy boost. Generally, no specific health claims, of course, and that's in order for these companies to avoid the wrath of our federal enforcement agencies. And as the old saying goes, if it ain't specific, then it ain't scientific. So if there's no specific health claims, that is a red flag. I made that up, by the way. It's not an old saying.
It's very Johnny Cochran of you.
But people do seem to be utilizing this drug for rather specific purposes. For example, as a natural cure to combat opioid withdrawal symptoms. The number of people impacted are really not well known. It's not very well tracked by local governments and agencies. And it actually takes a specific test to detect kratom in the body. Instead of some of the more common toxicological tests. So there's no really good way to know if there are actually more deaths out there that are related to the use of kratom. But according to the American Kratom Association, which is a Colorado-based nonprofit funded to promote the herbal product, they estimate that 3 million to 5 million people in the United States use or have used kratom.
Wow.
It is a billion-dollar business, probably a multi-billion-dollar business, if you also include the black market that exists. Oh, and let's see. Oh, the American Kratom Association. Here's what it says right on their website, right on their mission statement page, as it were.
They are committed to restoring full consumer access to Kratom and preserve and protect the freedom of consumers in the United States to make their own choices on their well-being and maintaining a healthy lifestyle. In other words, we're a lobbyist group. This is about freedom of the consumer and, you know, to hell with any adverse health effects that it may have. We're going to sell our product because it's not illegal yet to do so. Now, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, announced in 2016 it was going to be reclassifying Kratom as a Schedule I drug, similar to heroin, marijuana, and others. But industry groups like this have lobbied to keep it legal and on the store shelves, at least for the time being.
Yeah, so Schedule I, just to be clear, means that it has no known medicinal effect, but it is a drug of abuse or a recreational drug.
Yeah, that's the highest.
It's the highest, yeah, that you can have. For in terms of regulation,
it's also,
it's the highest. But it specifically,
so it's controversial.
Means, yeah. But it, right, that's true. But it specifically means there's no, like, you can't prescribe it as a pharmaceutical. Doesn't have any legitimate pharmaceutical medical use
at the federal level, because marijuana is weird, but it's still Schedule I.
Well, that's why they think marijuana should not be Schedule I, because it's exactly. Actually it may have medical uses. It's actually, I still think, experimental, but that's a separate issue.
But that's where they have it, right?
Yeah. No, I think it's true. I think that, you know, marijuana should go down to Schedule II at least. But
like cocaine is a Schedule II, I think, drug, because there's like some eye surgery that uses cocaine as an anesthetic. Mm-hmm.
It's also in topical medicines as well.
I've used it. I prescribed it. That. I prescribed it for
for
epistaxis, for an acute bloody nose.
Oh.
Because it constricts the blood vessels. You inhale it constricts the blood vessels, and it stops the bloody nose.
But then you also get high.
Well, it's not enough. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny amount.
Tiny, tiny bit, little key bump.
Kratom is touted as a stimulant at low doses, a sedative at high doses, and a painkiller and addiction therapy treatment. But it has no medical value, according to the FDA. And they, according to their statistics, have linked 44 deaths nationally to the use of the drug in some combination, either with other drugs, or there have been some cases in which they've discovered that that is the only drug in one of the person's body, in the dead person's body. The Kratom industry, meanwhile, disputes the FDA science and data collection, is insisting that nobody has died from the use of their product.
What?
That's BS.
Lobbyists at work. I tell you, this is what they do.
So pharmacologically, apparently, it's an atypical opioid. It has opioid-like effects, but doesn't work at the same exact receptor site as regular opioids like morphine does. So and it does have also separate stimulant effects. So it's a stimulant and opioid-like effects at the same time. Sounds like something that needs further study. But yeah, that also sounds like something that should not be freely available without regulation.
Or using the trap doors that the supplement industry has created for itself in order to make itself available as widely as it is.
Yeah, well, they're exploiting, you know, Deshae, the 1994 law in the U.S., basically saying if you sell it as a supplement, it makes an end run around the FDA. The FDA now has the burden of proof to show that it's actually harming people, which they might be able to do in this case. But it's very rare, you know, for the FDA to be able to ban something ban a supplement under the current rules by design.
Yeah. In the meantime, agencies are trying to make doctors and help agencies more aware that this drug is out there, exactly what it is, and maybe they can gather more data on people who are actually using it and the adverse health effects that they are suffering as a result.
I wonder if it responds to Narcan, because if not, it could actually be more dangerous than an opiate, because opiates, everyone gets their Narcan in the ambulance, you know, if they're ODing on heroin. We'll see. Sounds like something we're going to have to keep an eye on.
Yep.
All right, Kara, tell us about this love child between a Neanderthal and a Denisovan.
Whoa.
This is such a cool article. It was literally just published today. It was published as a correspondence in Nature, a letter. The title is "The Genome of the Offspring of a Neanderthal Mother and a Denisovan Father." What? How could this be? Well, I mean, I don't think it's that surprising that there was interbreeding between Neanderthal and Denisovans. I think we've actually seen a little bit of evidence of that in, I may be wrong when I say 2016, maybe 2017, but I think there was a 2016 study. But the interesting thing here is that, number one, they think this was a first-generation offspring. It's close to half and half, at least in terms of gene complement. And number two, and when they looked at the mitochondrial DNA versus the nuclear DNA, that's when they realized it. So that's like super, super interesting. The other super interesting thing about this child is that there were very high levels of heterozygosity in this child. So it's very likely that these were two like disparate people. I guess I can say people, right?
Oh, hominins. Yeah, they're definitely
people. Yeah, they're still people. Disparate people genetically, which is just doesn't seem very likely at the time. Or maybe it's either that they got really lucky with this find, or it was way more common than anybody thought. So let's talk a little bit about what was found here. So the bone that this that was tested to find this information was called Denisova 11. And maybe we could take a step back and talk a little bit about this terminology first. So yeah. I think we've all heard the word Neanderthal. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so interesting, Steve, you said Neanderthal. I always say Neanderthal. I noticed that sometimes it's written with a TH, sometimes it's written with a T. And so I was like, I'm going to look this up and just see if there's like a correct or an incorrect, whatever. Apparently,
both and neither.
Yeah, both. It's both and both.
Yeah.
It's named for the Neander Valley, which is where the fossils were first discovered. But in 1900, and it was called Neanderthal. The Neander Valley, when you translate it, was Neanderthal. Okay. In Germany. In 1901, the name of the valley was actually changed to Neanderthal. And so, yeah, right? And so some scientists changed the way that they called the species as well, and some didn't. But apparently, in the German, it's pronounced Neanderthal, but it doesn't matter because we use the English translation, which is Neanderthal. So different, you will see different publications put a T or a TH, and you will see different people pronounce it Neanderthal or Neanderthal. It's totally up to what you want. Some people are really obsessive about it, like certain professors care a lot, or certain publications have publication standards, but apparently it doesn't matter. Okay, so Neanderthals are from the Neander Valley in Germany. Denisovans are from Denisova Cave in Siberia. Denisovans are historically thought of as Russian, even though there was no Russia then. And Neanderthals are thought of as European. And we have lots of Neanderthal DNA from all over Europe. That's a pretty well-established lineage. We have a lot of really good examples of it. But apparently Denisovans, we only have 4 known fossils.
Wonder why that is. Why haven't we found significantly more samples?
It's either that there just weren't significantly more, or that, you know, because of where they lived, because of how they lived, because of when they lived. You know, there's so many questions when we talk about fossilization. But if you were to look at a kind of a cladogram to look at how did hominins evolve, you'll see that Denisovans and Neanderthals were our contemporaries. It's thought that Denisovans, although there is some argumentation around this based on a previous study, but for the most part, it's pretty well accepted that Denisovans and Neanderthals have a common ancestor. So they split off after the Homo sapiens split off from the earlier common ancestor. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So yeah, you've got one lineage that turns into all of us. You've got another lineage that split off that turned into Neanderthal and Denisovan. Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing that there's interbreeding almost completely. So we know that Homo sapiens interbred with Neanderthals. We have good evidence of that. You can even see that if you do like a consumer genetics test, although the percentage is contestable.
Okay.
We know obviously that Denisovans interbred with Neanderthal, and we have a perfect example in this study, which we'll talk about a little bit. And we have a high level of interbreeding between Denisovans and Melanesians.
Melanesians.
Which are human. Melanesians.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So they just seem to have a higher rate, although you will see some interbreeding in other people as well. And it could be secondary to the fact that there's so much interbreeding with Denisovans and Neanderthals. So it starts to get really complicated. Interestingly, when we look at Denisovan 11, remember that is the teeny tiny piece of bone fragment, which was actually found in the cave several years ago and sort of just I don't want to say put in a pile. I think the scientists treated it better than that. But, you know, they find thousands of fragments within this Denisovan cave all the time. It was so small, it didn't even look particularly human. It was, you know, put aside for study later amongst all sorts of extinct creatures. And finally, when it was looked at under through genetic testing, it was like, oh, crap, this is a hominin, first of all. And second of all, when they did the mitochondrial DNA testing, and remember, mitochondrial DNA is passed down from the mother, they were like, okay, so she's a Neanderthal. That's super weird that she's hanging out in the Denisovan cave, but whatever, we could see that happening. And then later, they were able to find nuclear DNA and test that, and they were like, wait, why is the nuclear DNA Denisovan? And it was really confusing to the researchers, so much so that they tested it from four different sites of this tiny piece of bone just to make sure that these samples weren't contaminated. There was like a legitimate concern that it was like, oh, we did this wrong. So we can start talking about the numbers here. I mentioned that Neanderthals and Denisovans probably spread about a little under 400,000 years ago. That's when they separated from one another. They think that migrations, based on this finding, they are now dating that migrations of Neanderthals going from where they were more in Europe up into Eurasia was probably 120,000 years ago. I think that Denisova 11 was 50,000 years old, and she was not technically, she didn't live to 50,000. She's from 50,000 years ago. She was actually a 13-year-old girl. Isn't it cool that they can figure that out?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
From this tiny little piece of bone. Wow. And they said it's as thick as a quarter is wide.
Whoa.
That's the size of the bone. Wow. Yeah. Teeny tiny little
fragment. They found it at all is remarkable.
I know, right? And then that they, you know, were able to finally process it. It was found in 2012, so it's been, you know, 6 years before they were able to finally process it and go like, wow, this is probably one of the most interesting pieces of bones we've ever seen. So her remains were actually found in, and this is an interesting thing, her remains were actually found in Siberia in the Denisovan cave, like I mentioned, but the Neanderthal DNA, so we're talking the maternal DNA within Denisova 11, more closely matches the DNA of a Neanderthal specimen that was found in Croatia, thousands of miles away. It more closely matches that fossil than it does another Neanderthal in the exact same cave. And that's what's really feeding into what I think the researchers realize is one of the most interesting findings of this, is that there were migrations much earlier than they thought. Because otherwise, why would she have similar DNA to a population that lived so incredibly far away? Also, oh, here's another really cool thing. The father's DNA, remember, like I said, was Denisovan. So they didn't find that out until later because they did the nuclear DNA testing after they did the mitochondrial DNA testing. The father's DNA had a smidge of Neanderthal in it, but they think it was between 600 and 300 generations previous to his birth.
Whoa.
So there was interbreeding even
generations.
Back then. Generations. Remember, they probably only lived like 20 or 30 years, but still, generations. And so that's a really interesting finding, that there has been so much interbreeding almost since, well, I don't know when, since very early probably in the genetic division. That's where these cladistics start to get really blurry, especially when we're talking about minimal fossil evidence. Now we've moved on to a taxonomic system where we're no longer looking at, you know, shapes of bones and other morphological features, but we're purely looking at genetics, especially with organisms like Denisovans, where we don't have any full skeletons. We actually don't have any more than just a couple bone and teeth fragments.
I don't think we're anywhere close to like a full picture. But yeah, it's been one of my favorite science stories to follow because there's like lots of twists and turns and new stuff happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even know about Denisovans, whatever, 5 or 6 years ago.
No, they're
ago.
So new.
Yeah,
we just found out within this decade. And I mean, how cool. And you see this over and over. I think I mentioned it before, but you see it over and over in the coverage of this, that people are like, ugh, did we just get really lucky that we found a first generation fossil, or are there just, you know, a ton of first generation fossils out there? We don't know.
Yeah.
Still got to look.
Yeah.
That's the crazy thing about fossilization. It's such a tiny little sliver of what was actually going on.
Right. And now we're also adding DNA analysis, which mm-hmm. we can't do on every specimen either. So, but the fact it's,
yeah,
it is
there
great
are a lot that they don't know.
Yeah, it is great that we can do DNA analysis on Neanderthals and their contemporaries. All right. Thanks, Kara. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, KiwiCo. So in case you don't know, KiwiCo creates cool hands-on projects for kids of all ages that teach them science, technology, engineering, art, math, and in a really fun, super cool way that you as parents will also enjoy playing with your kids.
KiwiCo sent me two more boxes. One of them I did with my five-year-old Dylan, and it was a ton of fun. So what they do, this box had a you're going to build a mobile of the solar system. And the cool thing about it is it's not exactly what you think. It has, because it also gives you the ability to light up the sun, and we had to paint it. And it took a while. It was a really good project. It took us just about as long as I think I could keep his attention.
With my 15-year-old daughter, Rachel, we worked with KiwiCo's Fire Lab.
Whoa.
Yes, an entire – it was cool. An entire laboratory in a single box right down to the safety equipment and mess mat. Rachel led the way. The parents played the role of lab assistants. There were experiments which demonstrated how fire and fuel interact and showing why oxygen is one of the three necessary components of fire. Also how a flame vacuum occurs. And one of my favorites, how to use the flame test to detect the presence of certain elements. Cool. It was fun.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love it.
Cool.
Right now, you can try KiwiCo for free. You've just got to go to KiwiCo.com/skeptics. Again, that's KiwiCo, KiwiCo.com/skeptics to try it for free.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. So, Bob, tell us about neutron stars.
What do you want to know?
Well,
all right. So,
you know what I want to know. Tell me about this new bit. There's a new bit about neutron stars. Tell
the
us.
New bit, yes. One of the new bits. MIT's in the news. Again, Jay mentioned MIT. Here's another one. MIT researchers write in Nature recently that the tiny minority of protons in a neutron star may actually have an oversized impact on the dead star's impressive properties. So let that sink in a little bit. First off, you know, what the hell are protons doing in a neutron star? Isn't it all neutrons? Well, not really, but kinda. It's an interesting story. So, I'll take any excuse to talk about neutron stars. So here I go again. Neutron stars are pretty much one of the most fascinating lumps of matter in the known universe. You'll notice the qualifier I have there because I'm leaving some room open for things that are hypothesized but not confirmed, like quark stars or strange stars, but let's ignore that for a little while. So when fusion stops after iron in a giant star and the core collapses, so the gravitational force is so high that crowding electrons can't hold back the crushing force bearing down on them. And that's called electron degeneracy pressure. And that's what holds back a white dwarf, actually, and prevents it from collapsing denser than the size of a planet. But with neutron stars, it's a different story. The collapsing core of a giant star is too heavy. Electron degeneracy is just a minor annoyance. It blows past that. The crowding electrons actually merge with the protons to produce a super dense collection of neutrons. And of course, some little neutrinos that fly away. And so what stops the collapse? What stops the collapse after that then? And it's neutron degeneracy pressure stops that. So the crowding neutrons push back. They push back with amazing force, saying, like the Black Knight, none shall pass, right? That's what the Black Knight said. But then you end up with a city-sized, super-dense neutron star or a pulsar. And that's where the pulsar is. But, of course, we got to go a little farther. What happens if you add a little bit more mass? Well, we know what happened to the Black Knight, right? It's a flesh wound. So the collapse continues, and that's where you get a black hole. And there's no known degeneracy pressure that can stop that collapse. And that's where you get the craziness of infinite density. What does that even mean? Well, how could that even happen? But what stops the collapse after neutron degeneracy? I don't know. Crazy stuff happens. That's what a black hole is, but we're not talking about black holes. So now we've got a neutron star. Did you know that models show that there could be an atmosphere around a neutron star?
What?
Of course, it's only it's only a few micrometers thick. It's not a big atmosphere, but they're calling it an atmosphere, and that atmosphere, as tiny as it is, would be controlled, they say, fully 100% by the intense magnetic field that can be found within a neutron star. So then you go below the atmosphere, and you've got a crust of normal atoms, actually, kind of normal, not like super dense neutrons, but kind of regular atoms. And they're crushed into this. Well, they're not that normal. They're kind of crushed into a solid lattice. Surrounded by a degenerate gas of ultra relativistic electrons. Hello. That sounds ultra relativistic electrons. Relativistic, but even more so, really, really close to the speed of light. Not just a significant fraction of the speed of light, but really close. So, some studies, get this, Steve, you're going to like this. Some studies have predicted that this crust, could be 10 billion times stronger than steel.
Wow.
So below the outer crust is an inner crust, and the models predict various types of layers that are very dense and complex, of course. And you could kind of generally, simplistically, you could say that it's mostly neutrons going down towards the core. The ratio of neutrons increases greatly. And, it is a neutron star after all. So, yeah, there's lots of neutrons all smashed really close together. But that said, there are protons that probably exist within neutron stars. But if they do exist, there's probably not more than 5%. So, 5% of the entire star might be protons. That's still a lot, but relatively speaking, it's really there's not that many. You wouldn't think that a paltry 5% would have much of an effect. So now this background that I've just given you should make this latest study seem a little bit extraordinary. So the researchers claim that that this minimal amount of protons could actually have a significant impact on the various properties of the neutron star, which sounds kind of out there because it's really only 5%, even though it's a good chunk of mass. It's really nothing compared to all those neutrons and other kind of particles that are there. So this is due to what's called, I never even heard of this, short range correlations. So short range correlations is this. It's very simple. Sometimes a proton and a neutron in a nucleus of an atom can pair up and go flying through the nucleus with a lot of energy. I mean, it just spontaneously happens. And that's called short range correlations. So imagine, got an atom, you've got a nucleus, a proton and a neutron will just spontaneously kind of pair up and careen off through the nucleus, which is very weird. I never heard of that. So what they did, the scientists looked at regular carbon atoms, aluminum, iron, and lead, and they noticed that as the ratio of neutrons to protons increased, so did the probability of the creation of these neutron-proton pairs. So you got that?
Yes.
So the more neutrons, if you're looking at any nucleus of an atom, and if you happen to have a lot more neutrons and protons, chances are higher that you're going to this weird thing is going to happen where you've got these the so-called short-range correlations happening. So if you can just think about that, and you can extrapolate where they're thinking now. So the study co-author Orr Hen, who's an assistant professor of physics at MIT. I'd love to be. Imagine being an assistant professor, or even a full professor of physics at MIT. That would be awesome. So we think this is what he said. We think that when you have a neutron-rich nucleus, on average, the protons move faster than the neutrons. So in some sense, protons carry the action. He describes it as they do a lot of work, more than you would think. So basically, if this correlation or pattern continues on within degenerate matter with lots of neutrons, then even the relatively small fractions of protons in a neutron star can contribute to a much higher average energy or perhaps other important characteristics that we have never thought before within a neutron star. Wow. So that's pretty much it. That's the story. They're extrapolating from the matter the nuclei that they've investigated on Earth to what could potentially happen in a neutron star that has a super high ratio of neutrons to protons. This process of short range correlations where the neutrons and the protons pair up and fly off with a lot of energy, that process could be kind of going kind of ballistic within a neutron star and causing some of the very weird behavior that we see or will yet see in neutron stars. So keep on the lookout for more information about this weird behavior of neutron stars.
Cool.
Fascinating story.
Cool.
Very cool.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week, I played this noisy. Okay, so.
Wow.
I played it a little bit longer to give you a little bit more info. There should be some recognizable noises in there. All right, well, Marcus Noble, listener of the show, he says, long-time listener, third-time guesser, hopefully on the right and in quotes track. He said he worked summers in an amusement park when he was younger, and sounds like the launch of a ride. That is not correct, but that's a great guess. Listener Evil Eye, he's guessed and won many, many times. He says, it sounds like Evil the Eye. Gas on a grill, and then it explodes when he hits the spark. That's incorrect as well, but very creative. Robert Lawrence guessed, based on the launching type sound, I will say it is a bottle rocket, but I also hear something like a train going over welds in the railroad tracks, and I can't explain that. That's you're getting on the right track there. Rich Regaldo, Regalado said, I'm going to take a total stab in the dark and say this week's noisy is a rocket-powered rail car.
Oh, that would combine those two things, wouldn't it?
All right, so nobody won this week.
Again, you're getting too hard, Jay.
Dancing around it. So Jim Sherlock sent this noisy in. Jim is from Philadelphia, PA, and he said, I'm a signal technician with a light rail line in New Jersey. Part of our railroad runs in close proximity to a freight yard. The noisy is, he recorded the noisy there, and he says that it's a classification yard, or more commonly, a hump yard. Wikipedia has a good description. The sound you hear is the sound of a free-rolling tanker car coupling with a boxcar. It's a hell of a noise. The first time I heard it, I was about 10 feet away. I was not expecting the intensity of the impact, and as such, it scared the shit out of me. And he said he could hear these couplings do their business a mile away. And the recording that you heard was only 20 meters away. So that's a great noise.
Really, yeah, cool.
But you hear the rail car in the background at the end. I had to cut that off because I thought it was going to be a little bit too obvious. But thanks again, Jim, for the cool noise. We have a absolute brand new noisy for you. I really love it. This was sent in by Tim O'Connell, and without further ado. I love it.
Aww. It sounds like a baby dinosaur.
Or a dolphin backing up its hard drive.
Oh.
This one, I really love it, and I can't wait to tell you guys what it is. But you'll have to wait a whole week. So call me, email me, send a carrier pigeon. I don't even know why I'm going down this road. Just email me at WTN@theskepticsguy.org if you have any great noises or you think you want to guess.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right, guys, it's science or fiction time.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yes.
Yeah, Kara, have you recovered yet? All right, I promise to make these harder. I don't know if I succeeded this week.
Oh, great. Thanks.
Here we go. Item number one. Programmers have developed an algorithm for detecting fake news that works better than humans. Item number two. A new study finds that the color of images being viewed affects the interpretation of speech sounds. And item number three, a new published analysis concludes that the Milky Way had a 2 billion year gap in star formation in its history. Jay, why don't you go first?
All right, the first one here. Programmers have developed an algorithm for detecting fake news that works better than humans. On the surface, this seems cromulent to me that, you know, they would be able to look up keywords or series of keywords and collections of keywords that could do it much faster than humans could. Yes, I believe this one is science. We do a lot of things like this. Computers are really good at doing this type of thing, so I don't even have to delve into that. Second one, a new study finds that the color of images being viewed affects the interpretation of speech sounds. This is an odd thing here. So they're saying that someone has to look at the images. So they're looking at certain color images. It affects the interpretation of the speech sounds. Can you clarify this a little more, Steve?
Yeah. So if you, like, say you give ambiguous speech sounds to subjects, how they interpret those sounds depends on what color they happen to be looking at that time.
Okay. That lines up perfectly with my belief about how the brain is mostly there just to mess with us. Yeah, but I could see the brain doing something like that. You know, you have different stimuli will affect your interpretation of things. I mean, that's exactly what the brain does in lots of different ways. But this adds a new layer to it. But okay. The last one here, a new published analysis concludes that the Milky Way had a 2 billion year gap in star formation in its history. 2 billion year gap? I mean, why would there be like 2 billion years go by without a star forming? That's very weird. I mean, what would cause that? Now you think about all the coalescing gases, it's got to be happening at all times, but 2 billion years going by without any stars forming? That seems odd to me. I think this one's the fake.
Okay. Evan?
The algorithm for detecting fake news that works better than humans. I have a feeling this one is science. I don't know. Fake news has become something that has been able to be, I guess, sort of scientifically taken apart. And if that's or detected, if that's the case, sure, you could have a computer program do it. I don't see a problem with that. And, you know, we know about a lot of the flaws in human thinking and how they miss fake news regularly and can't detect it. This next one, though. The color of images being viewed affects the interpretation of speech sounds. What? Do these things have anything to do with each other? Why? Why are those senses connected that way? That makes no sense. I don't see why this is connected at all. Interpretation of speech sounds. Isn't that very subjective? I don't even know how you would measure that. I don't have a good feeling about this one. The last one's the wild one, though. 2 billion year gap in star formation in the Milky Way's history. Okay, so the Milky Way, we're an old galaxy, which maybe we've gone through changes if you're around for the better part of 13 billion years. And if we've had a time where, So I think this one actually could be science. It's remarkable, though, and it's almost impossible to grasp, but our galaxy's on the older side of things. I have a feeling this one's science. So I'm going to say, I don't know about this. Colors and speech sounds makes no sense to me. I think that one's the fiction.
All right, Kara.
Oh, man. I was hoping Bob would go before me.
Yeah, I know. Probably.
Don't you, Bob.
Wow, that makes me and Evan feel great.
It's split. I just think Bob might have read about the 2 billion year gap.
I know, me too.
Because the second study is like a super obscure psychology study, right? Like, obviously. So what my guess is what they would have done is they would have done a bunch of images with different color schemes or hyper-colored them, changed the pigmentation of them, and then, you know, played something that could be heard as one thing versus the other. And then if the people heard it as one thing when they were looking at the more green image versus the more blue image. I mean, it's a very easy thing to study, Evan. You're right. I can't connect why those things would matter. Like, it's about priming, but why would a change in color prime the interpretation unless somebody was like a synesthete? And I just don't think there are enough synesthetes out there that it would affect the outcome. This seems like it would be a chance alone finding. I just can't understand how certain color. I mean, I think people have tried to link color to like emotional states, like, oh, paint everything red and it makes people angry. Paint it blue or green and it makes people calm. But I think most of those studies are bullshit anyway. And I really don't. I mean, the only way would be maybe if it's a prosody of language study so that the speech sounds could be interpreted as either like, yeah, angry or happy. And then they used a color that was correlated with being angry or happy.
Well, that's why I thought it was highly suggestive. You know, like a lot of room for error there.
Well, yeah, but all it takes is something slightly more than chance alone for it to be found, you know, a positive finding in psychology. The effect size is big enough. And then I don't know about the 2 billion year gap. Is that possible? I don't know. So, Jay, you said the Milky Way gap is the fiction.
Yeah.
And Evan, you said the color thing is the fiction. Oh, shit. They both sound both real. And I can't go with the top one. That one's too obvious. I'm going to say there's no 2 billion year gap.
And Bob.
All right. Okay. It's a good one, Steve. I looked at a lot of news items the past couple of days. Didn't see any of this shit. Thank you very much. So yeah, the first one, the algorithm. Sure. I could see that. I mean, remember Watson on, I was that game show that watched
Jeopardy.
I mean,
Jeopardy.
Yes. Yeah. Looking up information, pulling data. I mean, if you could have a sophisticated enough algorithm to, I mean, you could also query a database of like these top 50 sites are very sketchy. Don't trust any news. I mean, that could be one stop for the algorithm. Then the other stop could just be just the basic, you know, basic stuff to find out if something is real. I mean, I could buy that as a bottom line. I can kind of buy that. That doesn't seem outrageous. The second one, I could kind of see, I could see that that the priming, something very subtle could put somebody over the edge in terms of how they interpret, you know, some random ambiguous phonemes. I could kind of see that happening. You know how different colors of rooms can affect your mood. I mean, I understand. It makes sense that it would take very little to put you over the edge to come up with a different interpretation of a sound. So I can kind of buy that one a little bit as well. The third one, though, I'm just don't understand how 2 billion years, 1/6 of the Milky Way's life or so, 2 billion years without forming stars. And don't forget, during the 13 billion plus years in the Milky Way's existence, we have merged with dozens of Milky Way, of dwarf galaxies and other galaxies. You know, we're merging with a dwarf galaxy right now. And when you merge with another galaxy, even a dwarf galaxy, there's going to be star formation because you have huge clumps of gas colliding together. And that's basically going to, you know, cause stars to form. And then outside of that, why would it stop for such a long period of time? The gas didn't go anywhere. Sure, there were ups and downs in terms of star formation, but a huge gap where no formation for 2 billion years, it just seems like too long. Generally, I try not to doubt these type of astronomy stories because so much crazy, awesome shit happens out there. But this one, I just can't justify it in my mind, much less so than the other two. So I'll say that the Milky Way is fiction.
All right. Wow, Evan, you're out there on your own, on your lonesome.
It is lonesome
out
here.
All right, well, is this going to be Evan's week to have the solo fail? We'll see.
No fail.
Let's start with the first one where you all agree on that. Programmers have developed an algorithm for detecting fake news that works better than humans.
Hope it's fiction.
Yeah.
Let me just say before I tell you if it's real or not, Bob, there's no mention in here of looking things up in a database. This is purely algorithmic evaluation, not referencing any. It's not an expert system. It's not looking up in a database. It's just an algorithm.
It could be a really sophisticated algorithm that looks up shit.
But it's not looking up stuff.
Yeah, I get you.
Only evaluating the report itself. But anyway,
I should
find inconsistencies or something.
Yes, this one is science.
Yeah, no, you're right, science. You're right. I should have considered that as well.
The algorithm was correct 76% of the time compared to human success rate of 70% of the time in this study. And what the algorithm does, this was developed by researchers at the University of Michigan, Radha Mahalsia. UM computer science and engineering professor behind the project. So Radha came up with an algorithm that basically does that evaluates the news item, the report for punctuation, word use, grammar, and those types of things, right? So it's not really checking. It's not fact checking. It's just seeing the style of it and was able to detect fake news 76% of the time, better than people, by doing that kind of analysis. Yeah, it's very interesting. And that does make sense. Absolutely. We were talking before about finding patterns in fake data or, you know, in fraud, or you can use these kind of algorithms to detect plagiarism. And you can also use these kind of algorithms to detect authorship, right? We talked about that recently, Kara. That was something you discussed, right?
Yeah.
So this is the same kind of thing. You know, the fake news, I guess, has a certain pattern to it that 76% of the time this algorithm was able to pull it out.
Yeah, but you can't tell them what that pattern is and they'll work around it.
I know. That's the thing. It's got to be like Google. You got to keep your algorithm secret. Otherwise, people will do it. But you could still see people trying to break the typical pattern, even if they don't know the details, just so it doesn't get picked up by the algorithm. And of course, this would be useful in social media because, although, you know, it's also dangerous, I think, you know, but the problem is that by the time fake news is identified as fake news in social media, the damage is all done, over. Right? It's too late. It's been seen by everybody. They're on to the next thing. So you really have to filter these things out before they go viral. In order to prevent that damage. So this kind of thing may be able to do that. Now, of course, the big problem would be in false positives, right? You're filtering out real news because the algorithm picks it up as fake. So there would have to be some kind of appeal process to say, no, you flagged my news as fake when it was real.
Yeah, good point.
Which would be a pain in the ass. But, you know, whatever. I think it's we have to explore new ways of dealing with the flow of information on social media. And this may not... This approach may ultimately, the risks and benefits, the return on investment, whatever, may not be a good deal in the end, but it might be worth trying in a limited way or whatever, see how it goes. So I don't know if this ultimately would have a specific application, but certainly you can imagine that it could. We will see. What do you guys think about that? Like having algorithms filtering stories out of Facebook or Twitter?
Absolutely.
Or whatever.
Awesome. Yeah, we need that shit. Let's do it tomorrow.
I don't know.
Yeah. Why not?
I don't know how I feel about it.
Why would you feel bad about it?
Because then people are just going to figure out how to beat the algorithm. I guess it's the same as anything else. Well, people try to beat the algorithm with how to get their stories promoted or how to get their story. I mean, they already have algorithms for, you know, what you see on your feed and what you don't
see.
I like the old school view. Like, everybody's always fighting on Twitter and on Instagram for just show me what I follow in the order that it gets posted.
Yeah.
Don't give me an algorithm. Just let me see what I've chosen to follow in the order that
you should have that option. You should have that option.
None of them do it that way. They all have like weird ways to – anyway. And I think it's the same thing. Yeah, it's great like for the society. But at the same time, if people want to be able to read conspiratorial garbage, they should be able to. Free press.
All right.
Yeah. It's true, right?
True.
There is that.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Let's move on to number two. A new study finds that the color of images being viewed affects the interpretation of speech sounds. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. Evan, have you ever heard of the McGurk effect?
Yes, I've heard of the
McGurk
effect.
I love it. It's so cool.
Yeah, what is it?
It's when you a noise is happening and but it's
ambiguous.
Yeah, it's ambiguous. And then you make a suggestion as to what they are saying, and then you believe it, even though it may not be true.
Close.
You can interpret the same thing two different ways based on different kinds of – like there's a video, a really good video of the best McGurk effect example out there. Where
Richard Wiseman has presentations of
right.
McGurk effect.
So
Fa and Ba. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, when you have an ambiguous speech sound, what you see the person's lips doing affects how you hear it. So it's an instance of vision affecting what you hear.
Yeah, but that's actual like lip reading.
You're right.
Sort of. It's not colors.
You're right.
Yeah, but colors,
which is why
right.
this one is the fiction.
Shit.
It is.
Oh, good job, Evan.
Damn.
So did you just make this up whole cloth?
I totally made up the color thing whole cloth, but it was based on a real study, which is actually quite interesting. But the real study was so obvious, I just couldn't use it as a real one because it'd be like, duh, yeah, of course. So what they found was that the brain has what they're calling an autocorrect feature. But basically, if you hear ambiguous sounds, then it's like similar to the McGurk effect. Your brain will decide what the letter was, what the sound was rather, based upon context, meaning what the rest of the word is. So
of course, I mean, that happens to people all the time where you're talking to them and like 5 seconds later, they respond to what you said because it took them that long to figure out what that word was.
But this is a little bit different, though. This is not you conscious. This is subconscious, and it's happening. Mm-hmm. It's happening without you being aware of it. So they used it. They used an example: parakeet and barricade. Now, if you say one or the other of those words, and the P and the B are ambiguous, mm-hmm. parakeet and barricade. You have to get to the third syllable before you realize what the word is, right? Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. what you're hearing a second later, halfway through the word, affects how your brain interprets the first sound, even though there's a second delay and you're not aware of it. So it's like you're holding that information in a buffer until the context enables you to assign a word to it, and then your brain says, okay, that's parakeet. And so you hear parakeet. Does that make sense?
And you actually hear it. Like if people are like, what
that's
was
what
that
you
word?
Hear.
Like, it was parakeet.
It's not what you think you hear. Yeah, it's not what you it's not you interpreting the sound. It's how your brain interprets the sound, and mm-hmm. therefore it's what you hear. You hear a P.
It fills in the blank for you?
Yeah, it disambiguates, right? It's not a blank, it's an ambiguous sound, either P or B in this example, but it could be a fa or va, right? F or V or whatever. There's an ambiguous phoneme, and your brain determines which one it is based upon the word that it's embedded in. But it might take a second or so for that and to gather enough information. So it's like holding on until it has enough information. This is where that was a P or that was a B or a V or an F or whatever. Isn't that interesting?
It's amazing.
Yes. Yeah, that is interesting.
You see the video of it. Yeah. It'll blow your mind because it fools you every time.
Yeah. Yeah. You could. So we'll have the link to the study, and it has some examples in there that you could look at. It's great. Yeah. So then I went from that. I just made up the collar thing just to make it barely plausible.
Three in a row, yeah. I've missed.
You're tanking, Kara. Tanking. Oh. All right.
Bad.
No, you've missed it. You got one. Two times ago, you were correct. It was the time before that you were wrong. So you were correct, wrong. No, you were wrong, correct, wrong.
Wrong,
oh, I
correct,
thought it was three. Wrong. Oh, okay.
There was one correct thrown in there. Yeah, okay. Gotcha. All of this means that a new published analysis concludes that the Milky Way had a 2 billion year gap in star formation in its history is science. I was surprised at this too, which is why I made it a real one.
Yeah.
So
really surprising.
Yeah, it's very surprising. And again, I had to go. This is one of those studies where I had to go back to the original report, not the press release, you know, in order to find out what the hell is really going on. This study really was testing the gas flow theory. Bob, have you ever heard that one?
I've heard of that and I thought about it, but still, 2 billion years is nuts.
Yeah, so there are different types of flows, right? And so this is how gas is flowing into or out of the galaxy, and of course, which is what determines star formation. And the reason why they think that there was basically two phases of star formation in the Milky Way. There was an early phase. And all of the stars that created in that phase have a certain signature based upon their ratios of elements in the stars. And then there was this about 2 year gap in star formation. And then there was a second phase. Some articles talk about the galaxy dying and then coming back to life or whatever, but there was this gap. There was a pause in star formation because essentially no matter where they look in the galaxy, there appears to be these two populations of stars with different signatures of elements in them. And it has a lot to do with the ratio of iron to other types of elements like oxygen, magnesium, silicon, calcium. So it's those elements, what they're calling the alpha elements, relative to iron. So there's an alpha iron ratio, and there's two types of stars with different ratios. And so the first one were created early in the history of the Milky Way, when the gas clouds were primarily seeded by stars going supernova, and by, you know, with the heavier elements. But the later one, but then that gas basically at some point it got too thin for more stars to form. But that allowed for more gas to then slowly come back gravitationally, get drawn into the galaxy. And that resulted, after 2 billion years, that kicked off another round of star formation with a different alpha iron ratio. And that one, I think had more iron in it. And that was seeded more by type 1A supernova because they take longer. You know, they weren't type 1As going off in the early galaxy, and in the second star formation, there were. And so that's partly why the ratio of elements was different in the two populations of stars. So obviously this is not ironclad. This is a hypothesis to explain the observation of this fairly widely distributed two populations of stars in the galaxy. And it does solve that observation or that problem of why that would be. And it is consistent with this pre-existing hypothesis about the flow of gas in and out of the Milky Way. So I wouldn't say this is confirmed, which is why I framed it the way that I did, but it is very interesting result. Yeah. And obviously, I mean, you know, this isn't to suggest that not a single star was formed in that 2 billion years, but there was these two waves of star formation with a 2 billion year gap in the middle.
Dang it. I even said, it seems reasonable. Who knows? Maybe there is two waves of star formation.
There were, yeah.
Yeah, but what about star creation from galactic cannibalism?
Yeah.
That's not insignificant. I mean, we consumed many galaxies over the billions of years. So maybe that's just could that be a minor effect compared to these two waves? Probably.
I guess so.
But it doesn't seem to be that minor.
But it is minor because they're mainly dwarf galaxies without a lot of stars. And we can usually tell, like we could say that stream of stars over there, that was a separate galaxy that we ate whatever so many billion years ago, because they all have their own signature, right?
Yeah, but those streamers, mm-hmm. once you go back 6, 7, 8 billion years, I mean, it's pretty hard to detect those damn streamers. I mean, we owe our size and shape overall to a lot of these mergers. Not just little dwarfs. Who knows what we merged with 8, 9, 10 billion years ago.
Valid points, Bob.
But still, it's fascinating. But I think I overinterpreted it as like no star formation. But it was probably a minimum.
At least normal star formation. You know, yeah, maybe there might have been some bursts from cannibalism or something else, but the normal pace of star formation basically ground to a halt for 2 billion years and then was rekindled once the new gas flowed in.
As usual, a little knowledge screwed me.
But it's interesting too that, you know, I'm always surprised to be reminded of how old the Milky Way is. The Milky Way is almost as old as the universe. You know, the universe is 13.7 billion years old.
And I know, it's amazing.
Milky Way, the upper limit of the Milky Way is 13.6 billion years old. I mean, it could be.
It's 13.6.
Yeah, it is incredible.
I forgot it was that old even. I knew it was old.
It's hard to get much older.
That's the upper limit of the range. But yeah, so it's basically we were an old galaxy that had formed pretty soon, right in the first wave of galaxy formations after the universe, after the Big Bang, right? And so it's really old. So 2 billion years, out of 13 plus billion, okay.
It's still a decent percentage.
It's a long time.
So then are all galaxies have these kinds of weird waves?
That's a good question. The answer is probably yes. Andromeda probably also does. And so it's probably large galaxies do. Small dwarf galaxies do not. They have a more continuous star formation history. So large galaxies like the Milky Way and the Andromeda, yes, that seems to be the case.
Interesting.
Very cool.
Very cool, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Evan occasionally snags the solo win. Good job.
Good job, Evan.
Occasionally I do.
Thank you.
Evan, you got a quote?
Dolphins and monkeys basically could play chess together. Those are brilliant animals. Said by Perry DeAngelis on this very podcast.
Yep. That is so Perry.
Happy birthday, Perry. Today would have been his 55th birthday.
Aww. Yeah, it would have been his 55th birthday, and he was 44 when he died. 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It seems so long ago.
Yep.
Yeah, it does.
I know. My gosh.
What a guy.
Almost getting to the point where it will have been as long since he died as I knew him, like as the amount of time that I knew him. You know what I mean?
It's a sad thing.
Yeah. Think about it. Yeah. We do miss Perry, but his, you know, his essence still infuses the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. His personality, he infected all of us with a little bit of his personality, and it still comes out in the show quite frequently.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, yes.
There's an echo of him still bouncing around inside of the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely.
All right, guys. Well, next week's show is going to be the private show that we recorded at Nexus. And then the show after that will be the live show that we record at DragonCon, because we will be at DragonCon next weekend. Looking forward to seeing you guys all there. Woo-hoo! It's going to be a lot of fun.
That is correct, Steve.
That private show, if I remember,
that was off the rails private show. And it was. George Robb joined us on that show.
Yeah, that's correct, Jay. And we're going to do a private show at Dragon Con this year as well. They're always a fun show. We're all together, you know, we always try to do something fun. We usually do something a little bit more off the cuff, you know, so it means we could be a little bit more free. And so far, it's always worked out. Those always turn out to be great episodes. All right. Well, we're looking forward to seeing you guys next week.
You too, man.
Yep.
Yep. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible. And don't forget about KiwiCo. KiwiCo creates super cool hands-on projects for kids that make learning about science, technology, engineering, art, and math fun. KiwiCo's mission is to provide the next generation of innovators with the tools and foundation they need to become creative problem solvers and critical thinkers. Kids can create their own arcade games, construct a hydraulic claw, or tinker with electronics and motors. KiwiCo is offering the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe listeners the chance to try them for free. To redeem this offer and learn more about their projects for kids, visit kiwico.com/skeptics. That's KiwiCo, KIWICO.com/skeptics.